Hello audio listener, please subscribe, leave a like and review on the platform you're listening from. The video version of this show is on YouTube and the link will be in the description.
Okay.
All right.
Do you want to do the introduction again?
Hang on. There you go, that's my thinking and get it in.
I'll do one too, fuck it.
Yeah. welcome back to another Bass Coast session of the Music Matters podcast, and we are absolutely choked to have the legend Justin Martin in. Thanks for coming in, man.
Thank you for having me.
Justin, thanks so much for coming on the show, bro.
Yeah.
Just straight off the back of your set there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm still buzzing a little bit from the Bass Coast vibes. It's pretty awesome out there.
That's cool,
man. It was magical, man.
How many times have you been to Bass Coast? I believe you've been there a lot of times, haven't you?
I think this is at least my fourth.
Yep.
This is the second time I've played at the Sleigh Bay. The first time I did it was like one of my all-time favorite shows, so this one, like, I was like mentally prepared for just like this, I don't know, the magic of the Sleigh Bay, and I definitely like felt it today. It was unbelievable.
For sure, man. The vibe of everyone.
Yeah.
Been waiting for this.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
for
yeah.
so long.
Yeah. That's the other thing about right. this, that you can tell that there's just like such an incredible energy this time around, and there always is here at Bass Coast, but because so many people are being reunited and haven't seen
absolutely.
Each other so
absolutely.
Long.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a nice yeah. little community, obviously. This is our first
incredible.
Time coming, but I can just tell
it
is what it is, right?
Yeah, very welcoming. Everyone's just up for a good time, open-minded, and it's beautiful.
Yeah, man. But anyway, I kind of sidetracked with Bass Coast there, but we normally start off our chats with, like, tell us a bit about yourself, Justin.
Oh, okay.
Where are you from? Where'd you grow up? How did you get into electronic music?
Let's see. Where do I begin? My name is Justin Martin.
Hello, my name is.
I like pizza. I have two cats.
Pepperoni? You don't put pineapple on it, do you, Justin? Surely.
Honestly, I do not.
No,
but I am open. I'm not a hater. I think it's okay. All toppings except for like ketchup. You can't put ketchup on a pizza.
Ketchup on a pizza? Yeah. What's do people do that?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
That's a thing?
Yeah.
It's like putting baked beans on pizza.
Let's see, but I've been DJing for quite a long time, since the early 2000s.
Yeah.
I've been producing as well since, like, I think 2005 or 2004 was my first release.
Yeah.
And I love it. I can't get enough of it.
How did you get into it? Like, you know, what was your introduction? What first kind of grabbed you?
Yeah, so when I was in high school, I basically fell in love with electronic music after listening to like Bjork and D-Light.
Nice.
Slowly, like, I remember like reading some article about how Bjork was, I was like obsessed with her album debut.
Oh, mate, it's a stunning album. Like,
and incredible, like timeless.
I have it on vinyl. I love saying that when I got something. Got that on vinyl. Bro.
That's a good one to have on vinyl. I remember reading an article where she, like, I think she was dating Goldie for a second.
Yeah, she did. Yeah, 100%.
I don't want to, like, start any weird, like...
No, they did.
20-year-old rumors or anything.
No, 100%.
But, I think that he was, like opening for her on tour. And so I discovered her music, or his music, through her. And as soon as I heard Timeless, the album by Goldie, his debut
album.
Again,
another stunning album.
Yeah.
Which is timeless.
It literally
Literally is.
Sorry for the language.
No, it's okay. We swear.
Okay, cool.
We're English, bro.
It literally fucking changed my life.
Yeah,
And shortly after that, I discovered LT Bookham, and I just fell in love with drum and bass.
Sweet.
Started collecting records with all my, like, you know, my parents would send me money for books. When I was in college,
you bought vinyl instead.
I was spending all of my like my monthly like food allowance and everything. I just spent it all on records.
Sweet.
And I was going to school in New York City for a little bit, so I got my like, you know, early rave days, like going to like Twilo and
cool,
seeing Sasha
man.
And Digweed
wow.
and stuff.
You got to see Sasha and Digweed at Twilo. Like I've seen them play lots
every
of time,
month.
But not at that club.
Yeah, it was incredible.
Wow, man.
And then shortly after that, I moved to San Francisco, and I decided, like, I was graduating school. I didn't really know what I was going to do with my life, but I loved music, and I had this passion, this little hobby of DJing, so I just decided to give it a chance, and, you know, saved up, bought a computer, started making music. And,
sweet.
the rest is kind of history.
What about like your first equipment then? You were buying vinyl, so you have turntables?
Yeah, yeah. I, you know, I was like the classic story of like belt drive.
Belt drives, fucking 100%, bro.
I had a scratch, a Gemini Scratchmaster with like the 8 second sample button.
Yeah, mate.
And when I you know, went off to college, one of our roommates had like proper setup, so we were all in his room all the time. And what was the question?
Nah, it doesn't matter. Yeah. Doesn't matter.
So
equipment.
I was just like collecting records and DJing in the dorms and like playing like, you know, college parties and stuff like that. I didn't really get any gigs until like well after I had kind of like graduated from school. I moved to San Francisco in 1999, and that's when I kind of shifted from, because there wasn't quite the same drum and bass scene that there was in New York City.
For sure.
And okay, kind of shifted. I like went and saw like Mark Farina for the first time, and that kind of like changed my mind. And all the record stores were just had like an abundance. I had this vinyl addiction, so it was like, I need to spend my money on some records, and house music was where it was at.
For sure.
And yeah, there was kind of like a giant hole in dance music at the time. There wasn't a lot of like drum and bass inspired house music, and that's kind of where I started like getting this like these ideas in my head of what I wanted to make and what I wanted to produce. And you know, when I turned 21, graduated, I saved up, bought a computer, started using Reason.
Okay,
that's what I use.
Yeah.
Are you still using Reason now?
I'm not still using Reason. No.
Ableton.
No. Ableton. Yeah. Occasionally.
Yeah.
Occasionally, I'll like do it with the rewire or whatever. Oh, yeah. Like my old roommate Artelon, he still uses it like religiously with Ableton, but he loves all the like. You can use them as like all the different
as a VST.
Yeah. So. But yeah, you know, it was always kind of like my whole process with making music was pretty simple to start off with. I was like inspired by DJ Shadow. So I was a lot of my early productions were just sample based.
Yeah.
And I didn't really have a lot of gear or anything like that until like, I don't know, like in the last like 6 or 7 years, I like
started
finally like built
up
like a studio.
Yeah.
As soon as I had space, I filled it all.
Nice.
And now, like, I got too
now
much.
Now you can't stop.
I got too
it's
much
like
stuff.
Like Pringles, bro.
Yeah, right? Totally. Excuse me. That's, I could ramble on forever, but that's kind of like a short little history.
Yeah, that's cool, man. Yeah. What was your first experience when you came to Base Coast?
I mean, it's hard to remember.
Yeah.
You know, like I was kind of like a wild party kid for a while. So like, and I've in the last like 4 years, I've gotten completely sober.
Yeah.
But like some of like my early, like, you know, toured, like at least like, you know, when we're talking about like gigs that were 10, 15 years ago, it's like a little bit fuzzy stuff.
Party time.
Oh, yeah,
yeah, totally. I remember like leaving Base Coast at like 6 a.m., not having slept, like getting dropped off at Kamloops Airport, like just like a total wreck, you know, like and had the time of my life, obviously.
Yeah. Sure, yeah.
It's obviously like completely different experiencing it from like a sober perspective. And I like it a lot more. I don't have any of that like, you know, post party anxiety or anything like that. It's literally all just absorbing the love and the energy and having like actual conversations with people that I, you know, remember and stuff like that. But yeah, the early days, like I really have to like look it up. I'm sure if I like had it in front of me and saw like the lineup, I'd be like, oh yeah, okay, I remember that.
Yeah,
for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
But it's hard to like jog it out right now for some reason.
So growing up in New York, obviously you had some amazing clubs there.
Yeah.
What was your first club that you actually went to live? It wasn't.
So I grew up in Connecticut.
Yeah, okay.
And I lived in like a small town called West Hartford, Connecticut until I was 16 years old. And then when I went off to college, that's when, you know, I moved to New York City.
Gotcha.
I went to like a small school called Fordham University. And the only reason I went there was to go to raves.
Sweet.
Like, I really was obsessed. Like, when I was in high school, I was going to a few. Like, there was a pretty decent rave scene in Connecticut.
Yeah.
Or we would have to travel to New York. My brother was 3 years older than me, and he was working summers in New York City.
Cool.
So when I was, like, 15 years old, I was, like, going to my
already
first
going
raves.
With him.
Yeah, exactly. Nice. But, yeah, the first, you know, clubs that I would go to in New York City were obviously Twilo. Was
Twilo,
like,
yeah, for sure.
One of the all-time greatest clubs in the history of clubbing. There was a place called Carbon that had a club called, or a night called Funky Town, like Joski and like Oshin. There was like a whole like amazing regular like house crew that was just like dominating at the time. I'd go to Vinyl, see like Lil Louis Vega.
Yeah, oof, my God.
The V Recording Store.
He's still rocking things as well, Lil Louis, man. Yeah. He's still fucking touring hard, man.
The V Recording Store was at Twilo once a month. That was like Ronnie Size's residency. Gosh. That was.
We're reading off some names, man.
Yeah, man.
That was insane. Like, and what else like was a regular thing we'd go to? Sometimes Concrete Jungle at the Wetlands. Yeah, man, that was a long time ago.
Were you
but it was like those were the like it was like a golden era. You
the
know?
Golden
I'm so
times,
happy that
man.
I got to experience it.
I don't want to say it too often, but I kind of was pretty lucky in England. I grew up. I left school grade 10, so it's kind of because England at the time with Margaret Thatcher, that's what it was. But it was 89, 90. And it was just as it was like, obviously the summer of love in England was 88.
Yeah.
87, 88, it really came over when the boys
that's
came
like
back
the,
from Ibiza.
Yeah, those are the years when like drum and bass was born.
Oh, mate, for sure, for sure. Like, and I say, I kind of, I was lucky enough that it was free parties at first, all free parties.
Yeah.
The free movement in England, Spiral Tribe, DIY, Street Rave up in Scotland, all those boys were dedicated
DIY.
To doing the free party thing,
shit.
Right?
Yeah.
And so when they first, Thatcher kind of cracked down on it and they started like legalizing them. And most of us were like, fuck, I got to pay for this shit now?
Right.
What are you talking about? Because the parties used to be amazing. Like, I'm talking thousands and thousands of people in a free party situation. You know what I mean?
Totally.
And then, yeah, like you said, it was the beginning of the rave. So there was that whole sound starting, and then it went very jungle, and then D&B kicked off. And then for me, I was kind of like, yo, I was right into all that. And then the DJ for me was Sasha. Once Sasha really broke and I started listening to his tune selection and that style, that's
Northern
when
exposure.
Unbelievable,
yeah,
right? And Renaissance as well, another fucking legendary set of.
Yeah, I find it so fascinating, like, you know, when it was all happening at the time, I didn't realize how, like, everything that was, all this music that was being created was, there was no stuff, like, before it, you know?
No.
Like, it was,
so there
it
was no
all,
rules, there was no right. really anyone knowing.
It's all
like,
groundbreaking.
It's just
it
ground,
all brand
everything.
New.
Yes.
And that's, like, the beauty of electronic music. Like, now, like, a genre like drum and bass or jungle is something like, you know, 30, 40 years old.
And still going.
And it still sounds futuristic.
100%.
Oh, yeah, man. I grew up with drum and bass too, man. I saw, like, you know, Shy FX.
Right.
And all them boys. Nicky Black Market.
Yeah.
They were really, like...
I used to buy vinyl at Black Market Records, mate, for sure. Hey, even there's some interviews with Goldie talking, you know, about Timeless and Metalheads. You know, those guys were, like you say, groundbreaking. The shit that they were doing, the time stretching.
Right, I mean, that had never...
Shit, like, and Goldie in interviews, he's like, some guy did that and it blew his fucking mind. And he's like, okay, I'm obsessed now. I got to figure that out.
Right.
What did he do?
Yeah.
How the fuck did he... I can't remember who
it
was.
I just watched this, like, crazy video where they... I wish I could remember. I'll have to, like, send it to you guys and we can, like, link it. But it's... They were just basically walking through what you had to do to make jungle back then, like using the old
Steinberg,
like samplers and it was just so tedious and like, but it's so complex, the stuff that was produced. And now we have, like, you know, everything is easy. There's sample packs
for sure
now. Like, you know, exactly, you can do it on your phone, like, and But some of the stuff that like was made then, you just can't touch it. Like it was so groundbreaking, but it still to this day sounds groundbreaking.
Like, oh, yeah, 100%. Like you say, most of metalheads, Goldie obviously himself,
Fotech,
LTJ Bookham, like you say, Fotech, DJ Shadow, like he was a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
But all that shit still sounds fucking amazing. Yeah. Man. You look at all their old collection. You could play it to some younger guys who hadn't ever heard it and they think it was new. Like you say, it still sounds futuristic. Right, they'd be like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
Which I'm sure most people have heard it, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Right? And I love that, like, I feel like drum and bass and jungle in particular was always pushing the limits because it was like, it was sound system music.
Oh, for
sure. It was like designed for sound systems. Whereas everything else is like designed for like a groove or like, warehouse, like vibe, but like, it like as soon as like jungle and drum and bass came along, it was like no, we're gonna push the limits of anything that's ever been done, and it like eventually grew into all these different subgenres and like dubstep and stuff like that. I mean, I don't know my whole history, so I could be, don't quote me on any of this stuff, but it's I don't know, I'm fascinated by it all.
Mm-hmm. Like you say, it's very much dancehall sound system based,
right?
It came from that community. I don't know if you've ever been over to England. I'm sure you probably have.
Yeah, quite
played
a bit.
Over there.
Yeah.
Notting Hill Carnival.
I got to play that. I was actually just hanging out with B-Traits last night.
Sweet.
BBT. Oh yeah, man. Yeah.
I went there for
this baby T. I really wanted to see.
Yeah, man.
It was my first Notting Hill Carnival with her. And like we just like I like she just like took me around like, all the different sound systems.
It's
and
mad,
my mind was like,
and that's, well, the big ones, and then there's just the little ones. It's all, like, set up outside people's houses. Yeah, man. You know what I mean?
I've been going to Nottingham Carnival for years, and I saw Beat Traits on ShyFX's label Digital Soundboy stage.
Yeah,
and she was doing dubstep and dropstep, drum and bass. Then I was like, man, she is killing it. Yeah, with drum and bass.
Totally. Yeah, her in Red Light. Like Red Light was another one that I was always like so impressed by his productions, and he would bring like his clips, drum and bass like style into like more floor to floor stuff with the Red Light, and I'm obsessed with that. Like anybody who like really takes sound design and like trying to make things sound fatter and bigger, I'm obsessed. You know?
Did you do any schooling for your musical, or are you pretty much self-taught?
So growing up. Like I started like classical musical training when I was four years old playing piano.
Wow.
And then
that is the key to everything, literally. Yeah.
I hated it at the time.
For sure. Like, almost every kid I know.
Same at five.
Almost every kid.
But I'm so grateful for it now.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm so grateful. And then when third or fourth grade, I started playing saxophone. And through all of high school, I played jazz saxophone. So I was like, you know, like a little jazz trio and a jazz band and like soloing and just doing like funk and playing like coffee shops and stuff like that.
Oh, nice.
A lot of like improvisation. And that's kind of, I think, where I developed my musical like ear for things. And you know, some of my chops, I guess. But when I went to college, I put the sax down and started like really like getting more into electronic music, and when it comes to like production, pretty much everything is either self-taught or like just peers and friends,
people just network around you.
I had a friend, Josh Marcy, one of my brother's like college buddies, that like he gave me a bunch of software, like he gave me like Ableton and showed me how to use it.
Nice.
and that was like, you know, that was like the floodgates opening. Like I just never stopped. Like, and you know, there was like, when you first start producing, everything sounds like shit, but like you have all these crazy ideas, but you can't, like, you're like, I don't know why it doesn't sound good. So I spent like a good like 2 or 3 years just like figuring it out. You know, like, what does compressor do?
Yeah.
Like, how do I get my bass and my kick to sound fat? How do I like get things to sound better? And I'd say by like, I got my computer in 2001. So crazy, so long ago. And then I think it was like my first release came out in like, it was probably like 2003, 2004 when things started to click.
Yeah, yeah.
And I like, then I just had like, you know, it's like the CDJs were just like starting to become a thing. So I could like play my music,
my own
music without having to press it to vinyl.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a game changer. Like it enabled me to sort of like, I don't know, sort of make a name for myself and just like, you know, play sets of original stuff that was all like for me. So I think that was kind of like what helped me get my big break. Also, I my first record I signed to this label called Buzz and Fly, which is a UK label by this guy Ben Watt.
Ben Watt, I know.
From Everything But the Girl, there was this was his alias with his wife Tracy Thorne. They did that huge song, Missing.
I've got it on vinyl.
Yeah, of course you do. So, I mean, that's a good one, too.
It is a classic.
So I remember the record was called The Sad Piano, and I was obsessed with Everything But the Girl. Like, you know, they were, like, dabbling with, like, house music, but also drum and bass, and just had this really cool forward-thinking sound. And so I knew all about Ben Watt. He was doing this, like, these parties called Lazy Dog at the time. And it was like very uplifting, like groovy, just like emotional house music. And somehow we got him my demo, and I had my email on there, and he emailed me that he was starting a label and he wanted to sign it. And I thought, like, for sure, absolutely, that it was one of my friends fucking with me. Like, there's no way that Ben Watt is emailing me right now. I was like, this is no way. I was like, Ben Watt at Buzz and Fly? What is Buzz and Fly? And then I was like, holy shit, like, this is actually happening. So that was my first record, and it did pretty well. And so I started from early on going and playing in the UK quite a bit. I played at the End.
Yeah.
I played at Neighborhood.
Yeah.
Like, there's quite a few places that I would go to regularly. And yeah, those were, you know, the days I was still lugging around vinyl and just figuring it all out as a kid. Figuring out,
hurt
like,
your back, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. I remember, like, my first trips to London. Like, I didn't have a cell phone. I just had, like, a bunch of pounds in my pocket, and I'd have to, like, go to, like, the payphone and, like, try to like dial like whoever it was that was picking me up at the subway station or the underground, and like I just like a lost kid, like a lost puppy dog with like this big record crate that didn't have wheels on it.
Yeah,
like, really? What am I doing? How am I gonna do this for a living? Like, I cannot carry this thing. So shout out to Ben Watt. Definitely that guy like had a big impact on my career early
on. That's awesome.
He believed in me.
Yeah, man. Sweet.
How did you find like going from America over to the UK? How did you find the crowds? Was it different vibe when you got there? Like, was
So we were kind of at the time starting this this thing called Dirty Bird. It was like a sort of this free party that my brother bought a sound system because he didn't really want to go down the traditional route of trying to like hand out demo CDs to promoters and stuff that. He's like, let's just do our own party and we'll make it free and we'll do it in the park and it's going to be like amazing. So he bought all the equipment. And at the time, like, I was like, you know, going out a lot. San Francisco scene was really healthy. Like, everyone's super supportive. But it wasn't until I started going overseas to the UK and like when people started to really take me serious back home. You know, it's like all of a sudden they're like, oh shit, like he's doing it.
For sure.
And that kind of helped, I think, our party grow in the Bay Area. And eventually Dirty Bird became a label and, you know, the whole community like built around it.
That's interesting. I because again, even if you look back in history, it has happened quite a lot where there's been American artists like, you know, Jimi Hendrix right there.
Yeah.
He wasn't that big until he went to the UK and then he broke in the UK and then he went back and he was like, oh, okay. Yeah. Kings of Leon, another one. Again, this isn't electronic, but it's a similar thing, right?
Yeah, it was weird. Yeah. I wasn't really getting that many shows like in the US, but I was getting these shows in the UK and in Europe. Like, I played like Exit Festival, like, oh, just, really? Like crazy shit, like when I was really young. And then the only time I would get booked in the US is if like Benoit was doing a tour. Really? And I'd like go and like support him, you know? And then all of a sudden like people started catching on, and our you know, sound with that we were doing with Dirty Bird was a far cry from what I was releasing on Buzz and Fly. It was like this really weird, quirky, fun, like didn't take itself too serious, but it was like heavily inspired by all kinds of things from hip hop to drum and bass to, it was like just this hybrid house music.
Cool.
And I think like the popularity really grew from locally with that. Like it was, you know, we just started doing like when we were doing these free parties, as they grew bigger, we had to like find a way to pay for them, because they're, you know, we had to like get like rent like 5 porta potties.
Oh, for sure.
And like
generators. Yeah, gasoline, exactly. Everything, right? Yeah.
And so we started doing like a monthly, and we, all the money we make from the monthly, we pour into doing the free parties.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then eventually we grew out of the monthly spot, like because the we'd have a line down the block at like 9 p.m. For our monthly party. Mm-hmm. And so then we went to a bigger venue and we started doing a quarterly in San Francisco. And all these things kind of just were happening at once. It was just like, and then, you know, in 2005, the label kicked up and we started pumping out releases, and things really just like took off after that. It was like, I kind of had like a weird identity crisis for a little bit. Like I was like, all right, am I gonna go this like deep house route, or am I gonna go this like weird like tech house route? And I definitely like, I chose the tech house route because that was like where things were happening. Like it was ours, you know, it wasn't something else that I was like latched onto. It was our own thing.
Yeah.
And I feel like we did so many things like we had so many like groundbreaking moments that we thought there was no way it could get better than that. And it just kept escalating. I don't know. It's wild to think back, like how it all started, and like, you know.
Because for me, like when we was walking up to our mobile studio, I said to you, like in the UK, when I was DJing like 2009, your music and Dirty Bird, things like that, were just like, it's just like pumping. Like it was like everyone was playing it. And that's how I got to know your music and Claude's and everyone like that. And that time.
It's weird. I'm slowly like drifting back now to like this. It's like this sound that I've always wanted to do. And it's a lot more emotional, has a lot more depth than some of the stuff I was doing like in the mid 2000s, like, you know, 2010s. That's, you know, one of the reasons I kind of like branched off in my own direction. It was just to kind of have a little bit more creative freedom. Mm-hmm. And the sound didn't really match up anymore with what was being like pumped out with Dirty Bird. So I'm kind of like return. It's like gone full circle, you know. It's like I'm returning back to the sort of that, you know, more emotional, deeper sound that I kind of got my start with. So
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, that's cool, man.
Another question we've actually asked a couple of people before. Brad asked Joel West back in Vancouver this one, but when you're producing a track start to finish, how long does it take you? It's a great question. It depends.
Yeah,
but
I'm the worst.
Really?
I am the worst. I am like the worst kind of perfectionist. Even when a track is finished and I turn it in, like it's always like a month past the deadline. Like now I'm like, yo, are you sure you want a remix from me? Because it's gonna be like a long time to get. Just, you have to know that now. That's the first thing. Number two, like it'll be like, it'll say like final master, final version 3. And then I'll be like, it'll be like 2 days before release day. I'm like, no, I got a better version. we gotta swap it out. But like, it's to a fault. Like, I definitely have missed some opportunities because of my perfectionism. Like, just recently there was a remix I did for a UK crew that I'm like, I absolutely love their music and their, what they're doing, these guys, Joy Anonymous, and I just turned it in too late. And their label was like, we've moved on.
Too late, bro.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
And it's heartbreaking because, like, I play every
set.
But
it sounds so good.
And it absolutely goes off. Yeah, but yeah. And I was like, well, yeah, it's my own fault. But at the same time, I am a firm believer that you can't rush art. Like, you have to be happy with it.
For sure, yeah, man.
And yeah, it's a tricky totally thing.
Like, it is.
You can make a song that has beautiful ideas and, like, everything, like, is there, but you take it out on the road and it's not, like, it doesn't sound the way that you want it to sound.
For sure, yeah.
So there's so many different levels and degrees. Like, it's, like, the mix down, like, the actual arrangement, all that stuff. It's so important to me. I'm always striving to make music that is timeless. Like, I want people to listen to my songs in 10 years and 20 years and still have it sound fresh.
Yeah,
so if I'm not just gonna, like, throw something out for a deadline. Like, it's gotta be, like, I've gotta be happy with it.
Yeah,
so.
No.
So to answer your question,
I think most people respect that, right?
Sometimes years. Sometimes years.
Like, I mean, that's refreshing because we do have producers watch our podcast. And,
yeah.
You know, I'm the same. I'll procrastinate and I'll take ages, take me a while. And other producers feel like you have to.
I mean, I can knock out a track like in
the core of it.
Right. Like from like 0% to, like, you know, 99% finished in like 2 days. But that last 1% is like, it's going to take months.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And, you know,
I mean, I think, like you said, that almost, it is art, right? You're producing a piece of art.
Yeah.
And it relates to any kind of art form. Like, I like drawing and shit too. And the amount of times I've spent maybe hours drawing something, hours and hours and hours and hours. And I liked the outline. Yeah, that was good. Then I started coloring in. Yeah, that looks good, man. And then I did this bit of shading. Yeah, that looks okay. And then right at the end, I'll do something. I'll be like, no, that looks fucking shit, man.
Gone.
Right? And there's fucking weeks of work.
Well, that's the way it is.
Trash,
it's like,
bro,
sometimes,
you know what I mean?
Like, but sometimes you can, just by, like, spending too much time on it and not letting it breathe.
Yeah.
Like, you can, like, alter what the original intention was
100%
in a bad way, and then you, like, go back to what, like, your first idea was, and you're like, wait a second, I need to go back and simplify.
Yes.
But I think, like, we're in an interesting occupation. Like, you know, we're DJs and we make music to make people dance, and it's quite an oversaturated market now. Everyone's reaching for the same tunes. I like to pride myself in having an arsenal of unreleased music that, like, nobody else has. Like, that's my offering to my fans and to the people that support me. And, you know, I think it's like, I don't really, like, trip that much about, like, finishing things, because I'll test it until it's done.
Yeah.
Until I feel like it's, like, really good. Like, all right, I'm happy with it. And that whole process is amazing. Like, you know, I played like 5 unreleased tracks today that are just like ideas, new things, just to kind of, like,
ain't no Shazam catching them songs.
Right. No.
Yeah.
Hey, are your sets then 100% your original content, or do you throw in other people's tracks?
Well, when I'm doing like a 3-hour set like today, absolutely there's other people's
for music. Sure. 3 hours, like, is a long set. Right?
I want to, like, you know, as cliche as it sounds, I want to take people on a journey.
Right?
It's a slave.
It's not, for sure.
You know, it starts off at 3:30 in the afternoon. Like, people are just like chilling. You don't want to go right in.
For sure.
So, like, I love so much stuff like that, like all different genres and subgenres, and like I don't, like, there's not just one sound that I love. So when I get an opportunity to play like an extended set like today, I just want to dive into this, like, back catalog or this, like, all these songs that I've been just saving up for, like, that special occasion when I can, like, actually, you know, when it's not just like a festival banger set, you know. But if I'm playing a festival banger set, I would say like 95% of it is my stuff.
What's the longest set you've ever played?
10 hours.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Man.
Wow.
10 hours is the longest
that's
I've ever played.
That's a long set, bro. My gosh.
Must be wine and coffee and
Who was your pee break DJ? Did you have someone to take control while you went for a piss, or did you hold it out for 10 hours?
God. I definitely pissed.
The pee track, yeah. You know. Right.
I can go good. I can do an open and close without peeing though. Now that I don't drink alcohol, it's easy.
For sure.
Like, you know, just like drinking enough to hydrate, enough water, like a coconut water or something like that. Like,
yeah.
Like, and then you just pace yourself. Like when I used to drink though, it was like just sculling beers, like tequila. Like, okay,
I gotta go, man. Yeah, like, you got this right.
Put a long record on. Yeah, totally. But yeah, it's a lot easier now to do that. But I love marathon sets.
Long sets, like you said, the cliche, but you literally can do the journey thing. Yeah. You've got the opportunity to really go on that journey.
I mean,
right?
You can go up and down and back up and down
a little bit if you want.
Yeah,
you
know, when I was a, like, you know, just a young raver kid, like, that was the shit. That was like, you go see Sasha and Digweed playing back to back for like 8 hours.
8 hours.
And you just know they're going to go through, take you on this ride through all these different like genres and all these different like peaks and valleys. And
like a time tunnel set.
Yeah. And that's like, you know, I don't know. I feel like we live in such a, like, now things have become so ADD, like short attention span.
Yep. Short, quick, done, boom. Right.
Yeah, I thrive off of those opportunities like today where I get to like just kind of, you know, build a groove and
it was wicked,
and just keep building it and keep building it, and, you know.
Yeah. Oh man, it was a wicked set, mate.
Thank you.
What about thinking of the future? What you got planned? You got some stuff you can tell us about, or is it you got some
plug on the show?
So, so there is something that, like, talking about production, there is like something that kind of like clicked after that Joy Anonymous record. Like, I spent like, you know, a good 6 months on that one song, and then I was heartbroken when I found out it wasn't coming out. And I have a good friend, Lenny Kaiser, who's an absolute like genius in the studio, and I had another remix that was you know, had like a really tight deadline.
Yeah.
And I basically like called him up because I was having trouble with the mix down, and went over to his studio, and he just blew my mind with the way, like, his whole process and how he walked me through how he does his mix downs, like, you know, and how he organized all of his tracks.
Yeah, yeah.
And as soon as I learned this new kind of like organizational technique, I have been on a tear. Like, I've made probably like 30 tracks in the last like couple of months.
Wow.
And so I have like...
But you still got the 1% to do on all of those 30 tracks?
Yeah. I do. So yeah. Some are 2%.
So 30 years from now, we should hear some of those.
Right. But so the goal is... All right, this. So this... This is a long answer. Sorry.
That's all good.
But, so this is the 10-year anniversary of my debut album, Ghettos and Gardens.
Cool.
So we are in the process of re-releasing it with 17 or 18 new remixes.
Yeah.
From like, I handpicked of all my favorite producers, and that's going to come out on What to Do, which is my own label, that should be out in the next, like, you know, couple of weeks. There'll be a two-part series. Yeah. Once that's kind of going to take us, like, the label through the summer. And then the goal is to release my third album on my label, What to Do, as well, in the fall. So,
busy year, man.
Yeah. So that's the goal right now. You know, I was saying, though, that I was going to release this album in 2020, and then, you know, shit took a turn.
And then I
was like, all right, 2021 is the year I'm gonna release this album, and I kind of was like, things opened back up, and I went back to the drawing board, and I like just started like writing completely different music than I was during the pandemic. So now I've got like all these tracks, and I'm like, all right, I'm trying to like sort of piece together something that really, like, with an album you have to, it's a body of work. It's got to like flow. It's got to make sense. And all the albums that I've been inspired by are things that you can sit down and listen to.
The whole album.
without skipping a track.
Without skipping a track. Right.
It's a jigsaw puzzle, isn't it? Really?
Yeah, like right. The whole, totally. Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of stuff that, like, you know, I play in my sets isn't necessarily going to fit on an album. Mm-hmm. It's like too tracky or too, like, a little bit too, like, raucous, you know?
It must be hard process to get them sequenced like that to be happy on an album.
Totally.
Especially when you're a perfectionist like yourself.
Yes.
It must be very hard when you made so many
but
tracks.
But I'm making it happen.
Good.
This is the year.
Yes.
This is the year. So, album number 3, hopefully, by the end of 2022. And, and then, I don't know, the future's just kind of, like, just see what happens from there. Probably, like, get a few remixes from close friends again and just keep growing the label. I really like to, by 2023, open it up to start signing demos. Yeah. It's right now it's just me literally doing everything from, like, the artwork to the music videos to the graphic design, everything, all of it. I have, like, a team of, like, you know, like, my manager, like, helps me a lot. Shout out J-Mac. But for the most part, like, I feel like if we're gonna continue growing the label, the What To Do label, then we're gonna have to, like, grow the team a little bit, because it's really challenging to do it all myself.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Especially
to take all, on,
while
bro.
I'm on the road, yeah, like, man,
for sure. Sure.
I might respect you though for doing it.
And actually, I was just gonna bring up. So you mentioned touring.
Yeah.
How about touring right now? What you got coming up? Next few months?
This is like a dream summer for me. I mean, it's crazy. Like, this is the best that things have ever been for me in the U.S. And North America.
Yeah.
The shows this summer are incredible. This was definitely a highlight. I've been looking forward to Bass Coast for a while. I've got Shambhala coming up as well.
I've never been to Shambhala, but it's a pretty good one, too.
I've heard such good things.
Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah. They actually made me a resident at the Pagoda stage.
Cool.
Shout out to DJ Soup. It's like a second home for me. Like, going and playing there is one of the most incredible experiences. There's, you know, pretty much trying to hit every single city that you can hit in the U.S. In the fall, there's this big festival I'm really excited about called Portola Festival, with the most incredible lineup I have ever seen.
And where is that?
In San Francisco.
San Francisco. Are we allowed
to,
okay.
Is it been released, the lineup?
Or yeah.
It
yeah.
has? Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, let's just take a look at this really quick here. I've never seen a lineup like this.
3-day, 4-day festival?
I think it's... I don't know. I think it's 3-day. 2-day festival. Okay. We got Flume, Kaytranada, Jamie XX, Jungle, Charlie XCX, Gorgon City, Fred Again, Fatboy Slim, Caroline Polachek, Caribou, Bicep Live, Avalanches, Arca. Oh my God, it just keeps going and going and going. Chemical Brothers, James Blake, MIA, Lane 8, Peggy Goo, Tori Moi, Fortet, Floating Points, SG Lewis. I mean, it's insane.
That's insane.
It's like, insane. Yeah, so I'm really excited for that. Right now, that's kind of like the carrot dangling at the end of the stick. Like, I'm going to basically go all out and, like, just trying to put together the best set that I've ever done.
It must be hard to balance touring like that and also trying to do your label and producing all your tracks. Yeah. Like, how do you find the time?
So I, like, have been kind of shifting things from what I used to do. I used to do, like, the never-ending tour. Like, it was literally year-round.
Yeah.
And it was every single weekend. I would play 150 shows. And, like, I just always felt behind on everything. The pandemic and, like, lockdown sort of made me rethink everything when I had a chance to breathe for the first time. And I saw how productive I was when I actually had, like, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks in a row to just focus on, like, one project or two projects. And I was like, when I go back, I want to balance my year better, where I take, like, 3 or 4 months where I only do one weekend of shows, and then I'll hit it hard.
Gotcha.
And then, like, once I've done everything, then I'll go back and I'll do, like, another, like, you know, 2 or 3 months of just, like, doing one weekend, like, enough to pay the bills and keep the lights on.
For sure.
So I finished, you know, that ended, like, basically, I would say, in with the Detroit Movement Festival. That was kind of like kicking off into the full touring. But like from like January to May, I was pretty chill and just home being productive.
Nice.
Yeah. So I'm balancing a lot better, and it's better on my mental health and like seeing like light at the end of the tunnel. Like I love what I do. I love every aspect of it. But it can be really tiring daunting when you don't see any like, you know, breaks at all.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important not to burn out. Like, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years.
Everyone needs a break. Doesn't matter what you do.
You got to look after this at the end of the day.
Yeah, totally. Man,
for sure. Yeah. I think we should close up there, man.
Yes. Thank you, Justin.
Thanks. No, so thank you, guys.
It was a nice chat. Really appreciate it, mate.
That was a pleasure, man.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Hopefully we'll keep in touch, and you never know. We'll see you another show one day.
Let's do it.
Right?
Yeah. All right.
Cheers, bro.
Cheers.
Thanks, man.